From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, Governor Whitmer announces her plan on spending more than $1 billion in federal money.
It's big and it's ambitious and it's her stake in the ground.
And we'll watch as the pandemic peters out, rather than delivering the closure that might have felt more satisfying.
There isn't a red light or a green light and then it's over. What we're seeing in America, for example, is a tumbling down of both the cases and the deaths.
Also, we go into the weekend with a conversation with poet Petra Kuppers.
Finding refuge in words, finding the companionship of literature and the companionship of poetry was very much part of my world as I grew up, as I came into myself.
Those stories and more coming up on today's Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. On today's program, Michigan poet Petra Kuppers talks about navigating multiple identities. That's coming up later in the show, but first, Governor Gretchen Whitmer has announced her plan to spend more than $1 billion, that's billion with a B, in federal funds allocated to Michigan. Her plan includes increasing wages for some workers in small businesses and would try to encourage business owners to raise wages permanently. Here to give us a few more details is Rick Pluta, Capital Bureau Chief for Michigan's Public Radio Network. Hey, Rick, happy Friday.
Hi, April. Same to you.
Could we start by laying out what's changed to make this plan possible in the past couple of weeks? Wasn't there this big fight between the governor and legislative leaders about whether the federal money would even get parceled out and spent?
Well, what's changed is the fact that they've made an agreement to make an agreement and that we know that the federal money is there, that the governor is trying to move the conversation along. And so she's put her proposal out there, and it's big and it's ambitious and it's her stake in the ground. And now she's going to have to try and move the Republican leadership in the legislature in her direction as they're trying to pull her back in theirs.
Right. So how has Governor Whitmer organized her priorities?
The idea is that we are at the beginning of an economic recovery, and if we're going to accelerate and sustain it, that there are some things that we can use this $1.15 billion to make happen. And one of them is to create an incentive for people to return to work by, on a first-come, first-served basis, allowing some businesses to offer a $15 an hour wage. Also, to make it easier for those workers to return to work by offering them childcare, by making it easier for everyone to get childcare, while so freeing them up to go back to the workplace, and then this is something that she's been talking about for a while, to help people with upskilling so that they can get better jobs and move on up when they return to the workplace.
The $15 wage is interesting, Rick. It's not like the governor is saying Michigan's minimum wage is now going to be $15. She's merely making these grants available so that businesses hopefully will pay people $15 an hour for wage work. How long would the grants last? Is there any indication of like what kind of sunset we'd be talking about on this?
Yeah, the grants will last for 3 months, but to qualify for the grants, the businesses have to make a commitment to continue that $15 an hour wage for another 3 months. So it's a total of 6 months. And as the governor says, then after that, you let the market take over, the marketplace take over. That can businesses, I mean, it's kind of a game of chicken. Can businesses go back to a lower wage after they've already lured workers in with a $15 an hour wage? And the governor is betting that they can't.
Interesting. I see also that the governor called out strengthening the child care system for workers.
Right.
Obviously, the pandemic was a huge underscore on the need for that. How would this plan change the existing system?
Well, basically, it creates more subsidies so that more people can afford daycare. And again, that is supposed to help free more people to go up in, you know, to go back to the office, go back to the factory, go back to where it is, the restaurant where they work. I guess you would call this street level incentives. It's increasing eligibility. It's making jobs in the childcare sector more attractive by raising the pay.
Rick, I know that there was some hope in Washington, D.C. that the money for the states might jumpstart some infrastructure projects. Was any of that mentioned in the governor's plan?
Gretchen Whitmer is nothing if not an infrastructure ambitious governor. And so we're going to hear more details we're supposed to hear more details next week about more of what the governor wants to do, but infrastructure and infrastructure jobs are a pretty critical element of what it is that she's trying to accomplish. And remember, all of this has to be done. Both the legislature and the governor have said they're not going to use one-time COVID money for ongoing expenses. Now, in the case of the wage, the governor says that that'll be sustained by supply and demand in the economy, but really what that commitment means by and large is that these are going to have to be allocated as projects as opposed to sustained spending, like, you know, a guaranteed minimum wage.
What does this plan require of the legislature? I mean, some things it seems like they might be on board for, maybe the child care, but that guaranteed wage proposal sounds like it could be a bit of a fight.
Well, there are some, you know, GOP friendly elements, the grants to help small businesses with mortgage or rent, taxes, payroll, things like that. And I think that's an incentive to try and get Republicans to the table. I mean, I think one of the things that's still unanswered is what's required to make this a complete package, that no one's going to get everything that they want. So how much is each side willing to give away in order to get to a bargain?
Rick, thanks so much for the update.
Hope it helped.
Rick Pluta covers government and politics in Lansing for Michigan's public radio stations. The Michigan Court of Appeals ruled yesterday that a proposal to revise Detroit's city charter should not appear on this August's primary ballot. Mayor Mike Duggan's administration agrees with that position, but members of Detroit's charter revision and their allies say that city residents should get a chance to vote. Just today, Michigan's Supreme Court weighed in to somewhat complicate matters, staying the lower court's rulings. Michigan Radio's Sarah Swick is here to fill us in on the political and legal battle in all of its complications. Hey, Sarah.
Hey, April.
Can you remind us why Detroit is looking to revise its city charter in the first place?
Yeah, sure. So in 2018, Detroit voters voted by a pretty narrow margin, but nonetheless, a majority of Detroit voters voted to open the city charter up again for revision. So the city charter is basically like a constitution for a city. It sort of, you know, outlines the structures of government, the distribution of powers between the various institutions and leaders, and also, you know, lays out the priorities for the city. So Detroit actually amended its charter, its current charter, pretty recently in 2012. And those mostly had to do with improving sort of ethics protocols in the wake of Mayor Kwame Kilpatrick going to prison. But the changes that are being proposed for this charter are more sweeping.
Yeah. So these are basically the road rules that the city functions on. What are some of the changes that the Charter Commission's been talking about?
Well, there are lots of them, and they would pretty fundamentally change a lot of the structures of the city government and sort of what the city government does in Detroit. Just a list of a few of things that this charter the Charter Revision Commission made some changes to was there would be more sort of stringent requirements for city contractors, especially in terms of doing things like hiring Detroiters. A lower threshold for development projects that will qualify for the city's community benefit ordinance, which means basically that more projects would qualify for that process of providing community benefits to residents and affected communities. A water affordability program. The water rates would be limited to 3% of household income, which obviously has been a long time pretty contentious issue in Detroit. yearly physical and psychological exams for police officers. And there's a number of these changes made to the charter, and most of them have to do with quality of life and equity issues. This is Denzel McCampbell. He's a city charter commissioner, and he said the process of revising this charter took many hours of meetings over the course of the past several years, and lots of resident input informed what the final document actually looks like.
I think we have a forward-thinking document that is also setting up the city government to be reflective of residents' needs for decades to come.
So, Sarah, why is it that Mayor Mike Duggan has a problem with what the Charter Commission's proposing here?
Well, a couple major reasons. The first is that the revised charter does take some powers away from the mayor, especially in terms of control over the city's police and fire departments. But the big issue that the Duggan administration has really harped on here is cost. They say that this new city charter will basically set up what they call unfunded mandates, and that would violate Detroit's post-bankruptcy plan of adjustment, which the city is still must abide by, and would effectively put its finances back under state oversight. Now, the Duggan administration estimates the cost of the new charter mandates at something like $2 billion over 4 years. The Charter Commission says that they basically didn't provide the math behind that estimate, and they say that that cost estimate is way overblown.
How is it that this political battle became a legal one? It sounds like the courts are going to have to make the final call on whether the charter ends up on the ballot.
Yeah, they are. So basically, the Charter Commission submitted their proposed changes to Governor Whitmer, which they're required to do by law, and Michigan Attorney General Dana Nessel's office reviewed it, and their analysis found, quote, substantial and extensive legal deficiencies. It gets pretty technical here, but they basically found that some of the new things in the proposed charter could violate that bankruptcy plan of adjustment and trigger state financial control of Detroit again. Despite the governor's objections to some of what was in the charter, the Detroit Election Commission did vote to put the revised charter proposal on the ballot. They said there's nothing in state law, and actually the attorney general's opinion agreed with this part, that says the governor actually needs to approve a proposed charter before it goes on the ballot. So after that happened, they immediately got hit with these lawsuits that were attempting to reverse that decision to put it on the ballot.
Michigan Radio's Sarah Swick. Sarah, thanks for keeping an eye on this one for us.
No problem. Thank you.
As we mentioned earlier, the Michigan Supreme Court has stayed the lower court's rulings, meaning that the charter revision proposal remains on the ballot for the moment. The state Supreme Court is still considering whether to take up the Charter Commission's appeal. In just a moment, as more people get COVID-19 vaccines and cases drop, how will we know when the pandemic is over? After the break, a conversation with medical historian Howard Markell. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. In the record books of the COVID-19 pandemic, there will be images from the spring of 2021. Officials at the White House and around the country taking off their masks and sharing their smiling faces when the CDC announced that masks were no longer necessary for vaccinated people. It was a moment, a true shift. But in many ways, it was an artificial and arbitrary moment. Pandemics don't have a finish line. Vaccinated people aren't marathon runners with their arms outstretched, crossing over some kind of post-pandemic finish line. Dr. Howard Markell, medical historian with the University of Michigan and sometime guest on Stateside, tells us that pandemics are more marathon sprints that turn into jogs and then slow down to speed walking, maybe ultimately crawling before they stop. He joins us now. Howard, welcome back.
Great to be here, April.
I should mention that we're still not quite face to face.
That's true.
Yet.
That's true. I would like to be great. What is here? What does here mean?
I know.
Sounds almost presidential. Depends on what is, I guess.
What have you noticed about how pandemics and epidemics typically come to their close? What length of time is that arc?
Well, it's generally, as you just said so well, a very vague ending, a sputtering out, if you will. T.S. Eliot wrote a poem in 1925 called The Hollow Men, and there's a phrase in there that this is the way the world ends. It's not with a bang, but with a whimper. The point is that There isn't a red light or a green light and then it's over. What we're seeing in America, for example, is a tumbling down of both the cases and the deaths, which is exactly what you would expect with a successful mass vaccination program. Aside from concepts of herd immunity or how many people are vaccinated, we have seen rather consistently for a couple of months now, fewer cases and fewer deaths. And the hope is that the more people we vaccinate, the more freedom from this disease we gain.
This is in such stark contrast to the messaging I feel like we've been getting from Washington to Lansing and all points in between, saying, you know, the CDC says if you're vaccinated, it's okay to take that mask off in indoor and outdoor settings. And I just feel like I can't get my head around it. Like, are we, does that mean we're done? It sounds like you're saying we're not.
Well, no, I think if you are doubly vaccinated, if you took a two-dose vaccine, if you're fully vaccinated, the risks are incredibly small that you would contract COVID. And if you did, you might not even get sick at all, but you might be able to transmit it. That's more than a theoretical risk, but it's not a huge risk like it was when we were telling people who were not vaccinated, say, 8 or 9 months ago, you know, don't go out and intermingle with other people. The reality is that if you're doubly vaccinated, you probably don't have to wear a face mask. I say probably because nobody knows the exact answer. Mm-hmm. But a lot of us are wearing face masks in public anyway, just to calm other people down. And that's more of a prophylactic use of the face mask than an immediate use of it. Mm-hmm. And people are hesitant to give up their mask, by the way. You know, that's the other part. It's almost like a security blanket.
When we're talking about long-lasting public health crises, the bubonic plague or smallpox or, I don't know, maybe even the AIDS epidemic, which we now think of as a manageable, if dangerous, chronic condition – do you see a certain level of acceptance that comes with human behavior? People saying, this is something that is with us now. This is something that we must live with.
Well, certainly, you know, the more familiarity that the human species has with a disease or an event or any number of things, the better they handle it. That's how our brain works. In terms of HIV, it's a manageable problem, a chronic disease, if you have good insurance, it can pay for the medications. But if you live in an impoverished country and don't have access to that care, it's still pretty deadly and rather quickly at that. What I think with COVID or coronavirus is that this is not the last of it. We may see the same strain or other strains or other variants come back in the years to come. We may need more than one COVID shot, almost an annual basis, as we do with the influenza shot. And that will show some acceptance, the way you described, April, some acceptance that this disease is with us. So time will tell. I am not happy, particularly looking at some states with you know, how badly some of the states in the United States are accepting vaccination. And I think that will prove a long-term problem of what's called endemic infectious diseases, where cases just pop up here and there among these stragglers who are still not immune to COVID.
Right. We go from a pandemic to something endemic.
Yeah.
The other thing that strikes me is, if we do talk about this as a long tail that needs a bit of an adjustment for, like you say, the endemic things that pop up, and it's not really a smooth ramp down.
Nor was it a smooth ramp up, by the way. It wasn't exactly an escalator ride up either. So,
For sure. What are some of the other difficulties that you can think of for societies adjusting to long dwindling aspects of epidemics?
Well, I think the biggest hurdle that most of us, including myself, are facing is one in our own mind. Of course, viruses are invisible to the human eye. Unless somebody is coughing or sneezing, we really can't tell if somebody just breathing on us is, infecting us. So it was really quite a scary situation. And now, after a year and some months of holing up in our homes and using up our Netflix accounts, when we start venturing out, like going to the grocery store or to the mall or to the movie theaters, it seems somewhat overwhelming. The noise of a crowd, too many people, can be somewhat overwhelming. And so I'm recommending to people, first of all, get doubly vaccinated, but then, sort of stick your toe in the water like it's a cold pool and see how you do, and then dip a little bit more and a little bit more until you feel comfortable. And this is a psychological thing, though, not an epidemiological problem. This is how we are all going to be dealing with re-entering the world pre-COVID. And of course, we're all anxious to do that, but we're not going to do that overnight.
When public health crises do peter out, does that sometimes lead to substantive changes in human behavior or in society?
Rarely. The most common conclusion to an epidemic or a pandemic is something I call profound amnesia. As soon as it's gone, people go on to their merry ways and live their lives and pursue their interests as they did before. By the way, we've never had, though, a pandemic that basically shut down the world for 1 year and a couple of months. So we've never had anything quite that extensive ever happen in human history. But most of the time, people just forget about it. And most vexingly, at least to me, is that the epidemiological cracks in the armor that led to that problem in the first place are also forgotten about. And then 20 or 30, whatever years later, guess what? The problem pops up again. And so that's the other thing about these infectious diseases. We never really conquer them. At best, we wrestle them to a draw, and we always have to be on guard.
What do you think the best way is then for public health folks and leaders to help people adjust to changing circumstances? I mean, is there a way, if infections continue, to just say, hey, COVID is still going on, let's stay the course in terms of trying to restrict it, and please do continue to get vaccinated if you haven't already?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's part of the message. A lot of it depends if a new type of COVID comes up, or say a different form of influenza, or nothing at all. So it really depends on what's out there in the viral universe. But frequent communication with our leaders, such as the head of the CDC or the Surgeon General, so that they become familiar faces to you and you trust them. And you can go to their websites too, by the way. The CDC.gov is a superb website for information on almost any disease you can come up with, but especially COVID. And while their advice may change depending on the situation, by talking with that person, or at least watching them and listening to them, we grow to trust them and to follow their advice, just like you do with your own doctor. So I'm looking forward to how Dr. Fauci and his colleagues continue to communicate with the American people. But, it really is a two-way dialogue, because if the doctors we have entrusted with our health are telling us to get vaccinated and it's safe, then I would say that's pretty good advice to follow.
Yeah. So if the pandemic falls in a forest and no one's around to hear it because they're all out maskless at a restaurant, does it make a sound?
I think only if the bear is a pope.
Not this bear.
I'm not that
unqualified. Good.
There is a joke about that somewhere. No, look, yeah, I mean, yeah, that's exactly it. And they are invisible to begin with, and they don't leave a sound, and they often don't, but they do leave a trace, you see. And they leave a trace, in this case, of a record of, an incredible amount of record of deaths and cases that rivals the influenza pandemic of 1918. So for me, as a public health educator and an epidemiologist and a historian who talks about these things all the time and looks at these, I see this as a golden opportunity for our public health leaders to better instruct the American people to live healthier lives, and also for us as taxpayers to say, hey, we got to fund our public health agencies because look how much we needed them in this past year.
Yeah. Well, Howard, it's not over, but we really appreciate all the help that you have given and continue to give us in figuring out the strangeness of the
pandemic. It's not over until the stoop-shouldered historian sings.
Dr. Howard Markell, Distinguished Professor of the History of Medicine at the University of Michigan and upstanding, straight-spined human being. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, April. I look forward to seeing you in person soon.
Fencing might bring to mind images of the 17th century, the Three Musketeers, sword fighting, maybe the Princess Bride. In northern Michigan, there aren't very many options to learn how to fence, even fewer if you're in elementary school. But this year, Betsy Valley Elementary is offering an after-school program to help kids learn. Interlochen Public Radio's Kendra Carr explains.
When I arrived, fifth grader Carrie Kelly was geared up in her whites, the protective clothing worn to prevent harm during matches, and was up against her instructor.
If I'm coming close and you're doing this, I'm not afraid. But if I'm coming close and you're doing that, oh, then I'm really, really afraid. Then I have to take the whites.
Carrie didn't have any experience with fencing when she started, but that didn't deter her.
I like playing sports and I wanted to give it a shot.
Fencing has been a sport since the 15th century and can improve endurance, flexibility, and reflexes. But student Addison Hogarth says it's also a mental sport.
It's really fun, but it's also hard because when you go to go against someone, they might try to trick you and then you're the one that gets tagged.
Currently, there are 8 students enrolled, and they're focusing on the basics, says instructor Julia Klein.
Parries and counterattack and footwork, which is really important, footwork. But, you know, they're really new. I mean, they have no idea what to expect or what's to do.
The club was Julia's idea and has been in the works since 2019. That was when Julia was hired by the SEEDS after-school program and pitched the idea. Most of the other SEEDS after-school programs are focused on science and ecology, but Julia had another idea.
I suggested, and I was a little too excited for them to say no.
The fencing club was postponed for 2020, so Julia was able to use that time to slowly purchase the equipment.
It's kind of hard to, like, buy all at once, because then you put number to it, and it's like, ooh, well, I don't know about that. So I kind of collected bit by bit for over the month period.
Now they have some practice equipment and an electric target. Julia says the funding came from SEEDS.
They sponsor all the party, all the equipment.
Areas like Grand Rapids, Detroit, and Ann Arbor all have fencing clubs, but northern Michigan is a bit different.
I mean, we're a rural area. There is not much happening here.
The only fencing club in the Lower Peninsula, north of Saginaw, is the Traverse City Fencing Club. Some downstate high schools have small teams as an extracurricular, but fencing for elementary students is nearly unheard of.
I didn't know how enjoyable it was at the first minute.
That's student Carrie Kelly again.
I thought it was just going to be regular hitting each other with swords, but now it's more exciting and stuff than I thought.
Some colleges offer scholarships for talented fencers, but Julia says that's not really the goal of this program.
To be active, to think through what you're doing, to read your opponent, which can translate into many other anything in life. It's really life experience that they can take with them.
She wants to continue the program next year, maybe even get a local tournament going in the future. But for now, Julia is grateful for what they have.
Some kids will never try the sports because they have no means how to. But honestly, I think here in Benzie County, there are fundings, there are opportunities that we can apply ourselves to, and if we get what we need as far as gear, as far as equipment, I don't see a reason not to have kids try and see how far they can go.
Okay. On guard. Good job.
That was Interlochen Public Radio's Kendra Carr reporting. We so appreciate having you tune in for Stateside every day. But we'd love to actually hear from you, too. Let us know what's going on in your corner of the state and maybe some stories that we might be missing. You can also connect with other listeners and Stateside staff about the show. There are a couple of places to find us. We're on Twitter at Stateside Radio. Also, you can find us on Facebook on the Michigan Radio page, or send us an email. Our address is stateside@michiganradio.org. In just a moment, writer Petra Kupper's new collection of poetry, exploring the strangeness of our bodies and the strength within us.
Finding refuge in words, finding the companionship of literature and the companionship of poetry was very much part of my world as I grew up, as I came into myself.
That's after the break. Stay with us. You're with Stateside. I'm April Baer. The strangeness of bodies, the beauty of them, and how we live in them is a theme that weaves itself throughout poet Petra Kupper's work. These are intensely personal interests for Kupper's. She's a University of Michigan professor who lectures on disability culture and on writing. Kupper's uses a wheelchair and lives with chronic pain. She says that the process of poetry, observing and distilling her experiences through writing, is a healing one. Her latest collection of poems is called Gut Botany. We're going to start out today with Petra reading Craniosacral Rhythms, a poem she says was inspired by her wife.
Earthquakes everywhere. My head hurts till she touches. Her hand on my forehead. Her hand on my breastbone. Blood, magma, and lymph touch plates, send them shiver, suspend in skin sacs the corrugated surface of the cortex. Fissures and sulky, larger and smaller divisions, huge surfaces wrapped inward. Our memories fold around each other's fingers. Let me kiss the spot where the electrodes fasten to her temples, reset neurons, Frankensteinian fire, old techniques of fluid, electricity, and storms. Continents beneath, iceberg depth, into the brainstem, reptilian Urmama flaps her tail, search for connection. Japan may fold, California inch further away from Nevada, re-rest here. Our plates enthrall with each other, ping our way into our skulls, cover, cover, till the borders break open, cannot release, member post-traumatic recursions, member vulnerable stories, we burn white, bright.
That's beautiful.
Thank you.
Your exploration of bodies has a really strong sensual dimension, but also really strong sexual dimensions too. And for some people, writing about bodies in this way is the most difficult form of writing, either because it's really personal or just because it's very difficult to put words to things that are so much a part of the physical world. Have either of those two things ever been true for you?
That's a really beautiful question. And I think it's one that many poets try to address in their workshops, when we work with members of the public, when we try to open up what poetry does and can do for people, you know, which often is One of the things it does is to open up a particular moment, a sensation to words. And yes, that is the hard thing to find those words. And I don't think it was as hard for me as it might otherwise have been, because I so often found myself not able to do something full out in the real world because my joints and bones wouldn't allow me to. So finding refuge in words, finding the companionship of literature and the companionship of poetry was very much part of my world as I grew up, as I came into myself. And I enjoy the sound of language. My first language is German, so I write in a second language, and I just so enjoy the play of language on my tongue. And I try to capture that in these delicious words, foreign words. They're all foreign words for me, right? So I try to capture that deliciousness, and with that approach, the deliciousness of touching a leaf or touching someone's skin.
You know, thinking about this, Petra, as a multilingual queer person with a disability, it seems like there was just a lot to figure out about writing.
Yes, that sounds about right, yes.
Right. Your most recent poetry collection is called Gut Botany. And I feel like this has touched on a lot of phrases that have become very common. I hear all the time now about gut health and probiotics and every person's dermatological flora, the term for the microbes and bacteria that we all have that live on our bodies but that aren't harmful to us. But at the same time, it's a really interesting juxtaposition of words. Where did the title come from?
Yeah, the title came from much of the sorts of things that you're thinking about there. Anxiety so often rests in the gut, right? So another aspect of the story, which I'm not going to talk about in any detail here on the radio because it needs more space to unfold, is assault. You know, I was assaulted, and this book is part of a healing journey from sexual assault. And so much of the tension and the trauma of that manifests itself in the gut. You know, when we hold our guts, we hold our whole being. So much work in somatic work, for instance, is about relaxing or letting, not relaxing into formlessness, but finding a supportive structure that allows us to shape our experiences, to push things through, to allow us to think and feel things through to completion. So that was part of this notion of gut botany as well. You know, there's this notion to the natural world, botany, and there's gut botany as this, the environment insides and outsides coming in contact with one another. So that's for me a really interesting and important mechanism, how the images that we hold of ourselves and our interiors and the images that we hold of the world we're in and the land that we're on, how they can all be in contact with one another and allow us to heal.
Your teaching is not just concerning poetry. Of course, you work with people on their writing, but your teaching has also involved disability culture. And we're living in this era when, first of all, disability culture has a name. Second of all, it has something of a traceable evolution. And it's a path that people can follow as they're figuring out their own experiences. Do you notice anything about what disability culture and, I mean, if we want to get really into it, disability culture poetry, what this has picked up from queer identity and queer poetry?
Thank you. Yes, I celebrate with you the fact that disability culture is a thing, right? That we can say these words here. It gives me so much pleasure that you ask me a question like that. It's so rare still that someone asks me about disability culture from a place of understanding it as part of an identity formation, just like queer culture. So that gives me great delight, and I say thank you, April. And yes, the two have learned much from one another, because just like queer culture, crip culture, disability culture had to reinvent the values of words, right? Still in our shared world right now, disability has a very negative connotation for many people. Many people feel a lot of shame around being different in that particular way. In the same way, people who are queer found ways of recovering the term queer to make it a word of both depth and a history of oppression and also of celebration and joy. And I think this is how many people now are approaching disability culture. And it makes me so glad to be part of this movement, to be part of a movement where disabled people come together and with all our differences understand how important it is to love the body, mind, spirits that we are in the world.
Yeah. At the same time, reading the work of disabled poets, it's easy to see how disability culture itself is sort of a complicated concept, because people's, you know, the way people's bodies work can mean very different things about their experience of the world. And the experience of someone with, you know, with a hearing disability is not the same as someone with MS. When you're teaching, how do you talk about what is worth grouping together and what has to be an individual experience of identity?
Yes. So I don't tend to approach disability culture teaching from a place of individual different disabilities, because you're right, our experiences are hugely different from one another. They're also really different from one another depending on how we're racialized, how we're gendered, how we are classed. There's so many different ways in which we have significant differences. But by calling it something like a culture, we're being aware of the fact that there is a wide range of expressions in a culture. So I'm focusing on the cultural work that disabled people do of all kinds, lots of different kinds, deaf people, neurodiverse people, people with pain, people with mobility differences. We're all creating different kinds of artworks. And I'm just very interested in looking at what this art looks like. Very many of us push back against mainstream discrimination. So that's definitely a theme that runs through many of these works. Many of us push back against any kind of monoculture. So those are thematics that we can pick out from many different artists out there. So that's the kind of context in which we're looking at this. And many of the students that I'm introducing to disability culture have never heard of the topic and are not familiar with this as an area that one could study. And this is the same as when you teach, you know, queer studies, for instance, or different kinds of identity formations. So it's really exciting to see them understand that there can be depth and richness in difference.
It's easy to tell from your poems that you're interested in bodies as you know, not as a thing of interest and a thing that we can study and learn from. Do you also sometimes feel an urge to push back on the conception that non-disabled people often have of treating disabled bodies as kind of specimens, something to be examined and categorized and talked about?
Yes, yeah, exactly. That's one of those ableist categories. It's very important to understand disability experiences as unique and as deeply embedded in complex subjectivity. And that is what poems, what literature, what art expression can show us, that there's such complexity in the lived experience of disability. And that can in turn allow us to push back against the idea that there's, you know, that there's categorical experiences. You are like this and hence you are this thing. You're only identified by your diagnosis. Cultural work allows us to see beyond that.
If you're just joining us, my guest today is Petra Cuppers. Her latest collection of poetry is entitled Gut Botany. Can I ask you to read another poem from Gut Botany?
Sure.
There's one called Rose, Cardamom, Sea Salt that I just really love.
Lovely. I'm glad to read that one. So this is one of a range of poems that were created through drifting in public space with other people, with other disabled people often. So in this one, we're drifting at the Earth Matters on Stage Festival in Reno, Nevada. So readers, listeners, you have to imagine now the landscape around Reno, Nevada. Rose, cardamom, sea salt. Touch and silk and the rough edges of my fingers catch light. Rose, lavender, bergamot. Long hair twists across the plane of the eyebrow and lands draped across a single eyelash. Frankincense, creamy and warmed in the palm, it spreads. Ocean camel's back sways in the occupied valley. Rose, cardamom, sea salt. Sunfield crust, crystal white rings around blue and green. A red star in your third eye open. Rose, lavender, bergamot. Gather fields, hills, sun-drenched and thirsty, a wasp in my hand. Hay, and a light brown earth, sandy, drains frankincense. Altar boys, rose deep, red and white, sneakers peek out beneath the cassock, unruly rubble sways to the village, the cross, smoke ascends, waxen smell grave candles, drip red-white into the mast channels of my back, my hand, pools where I open a bird. Now new seepage, charter wrinkles of a new time, my hand a ruined map, not to be rehabilitated, longs, lavender, drowsy, rose drop, salty taste of my dry desert, frankincense, forgive all my trespasses, let me enter in splendor, gracias madre, red and white and purple, under the banner and the monstrance, my head bows into the depth of your nape.
It's getting a little bit warm in here, or is it me? That's beautiful.
Thank you. Now you can all go and smell all the beautiful smells in your bathroom.
Right. Petra, were there things that were more difficult to learn to communicate that you've had to figure out through writing?
Yes. Yes, writing is really good for figuring things out. For me, in this book, I had to figure out how to reemerge, how to heal. I had been assaulted, and that had been, you know, had been dealt with. I went through court. One of the poems in the poem is a long poem about the court encounter. But the real healing was about reclaiming my body, which had been maltreated. And writing the poetry really helped me to make that connection again, to reconnect with all aspects of my body, the places that had been made very vulnerable. I had to reconnect with ways of grounding myself. So I had, for a long time, I was extremely nervous in meetings, which had really nothing to do with the assault situation. I'm sure every survivor who hears this right now can probably relate to this. I just found myself anxious in very, very unusual situations that I had never been anxious before. So I really had to find ways of finding reconnection and centering in myself. So touching, smelling, seeing, being with trees, Michigan lands, the lakes that come up again and again, those were ways for me to come back, and the writing allowed me to make those connections, to sit with, repeat, work over those connections to bring myself back to wholeness.
Just one more question. Could you tell us about the place where you work these days? I wonder, I've got this image in my head of you maybe sitting outside to write. I don't know if that has any basis in reality, but I just wonder where you sit and think about things.
It does, actually. Thank you. That's a very nice question, too. Right now, I'm speaking to you from up north Michigan. I'm at Crystal Lake. I'm actually looking out right now over Crystal Lake from a house that's sort of set back a little bit from the lake, so I can look out over it between beautiful green trees. It's nice and cool up here. And this is one of my favorite spots to be and to write. So this is gorgeous for me. And then every day, my wife and I go down to the dock and sit right in the middle of the lake on the dock and go swimming most every day, too. So that's definitely a writing hole, a writing home for me. And so that's one. And the other one, of course, is my lovely, lovely home and party pad in Ypsilanti, Michigan, where I normally live. And where I'll be later tonight, actually. So that's also a very comfortable space in a beautiful neighborhood with friendly neighbors. And I love living in Ypsilanti. So those are my two spaces, both of which have good outdoor spaces. So in Ypsilanti, I have a number of white pines in my backyard. And a friend of mine, who is an herbalist, actually took the pine needles and made syrup out of them. And that's what I took when I was going through what presumably was a COVID experience last March, and it really helped me. So there's this really strong connection of working with and appreciating the creatures, the plant creatures that surround me in both of these sites.
Petra Kupper's latest collection of poetry is called Gut Botany, and you can find her tonight as part of Ipsy Pride at 22 North Gallery. Between 6 and 7 p.m., she'll be presenting and inviting you to a performance piece called Present Breathe. Petra, thank you so much for talking with us. It's really been fun.
Lovely. Thank you so much. It was real fun talking to you too, April.
Support for arts and cultural coverage on Stateside comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. And that's Stateside for today. Our show is produced by Aaron Allen, Mike Blank, April Van Buren, and by our director, Mercedes Mejia, with additional help from Catherine Nguyen, Nell Ovett, and Chantel Phillips. Our executive producer is Laura Weber-Davis. Stateside's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcast service of the University of Michigan. I'm April Baer. Thank you so much for listening. We'll see you Monday.